We have time for questions. Dan, you have something from the internet?
I have something from the internet. And it was asked rather early on, so I think it's probably directed at Michael. Is mesh, the medical subject headings, currently adequate for all the headings that might be needed for data? Will it need to be expanded? And I guess I think the answer to that is probably obvious, that for the range of kinds of data that's represented on the panel, obviously medical subject headings isn't enough. But maybe each of you might speak a little bit about the problem of creating and maintaining sufficient control vocabularies and what kind of effort that takes and how it can be done and what kind of mechanisms you use to do that.
Well, the answer, from what I understand, and I'm not a mesh expert, there are some in the audience, is that it will have to be modified. The beauty of mesh is that it is very well curated and a lot of attention is paid to it. And we have a whole team of people who do this and have done it for a long time. So for biomedical research, and that's all we're talking about at NIH, I think it's a great solution. The other thing is PubMed is where a lot of eyeballs already are. So when people are doing biomedical research in terms of looking at the scientific papers, they're using PubMed. So it's kind of a familiar tool, if you will.
I'm going to answer for the environmental sciences and say that in the survey that we did, which included some scientists who interact with environmental data who are not environmental scientists themselves, the vast majority of people do not use a standard metadata set. They use something that has been designed in their lab. And that is a problem for us in terms of either creating crosswalks that will allow us to look at their data dictionaries and figure out what these people are looking at to make sure we can do it across, or to educate people on the beauties of metadata and why we should be using established metadata schema.
And I think Susie's answer is exactly the same as true in ENDAR.
Yeah, I'd say the same thing, that we do have a high-level controlled vocabulary that we apply to things, but I think, as you saw, that's not where we think search is going. One of the solutions that we've actually proposed to DataCite, came out of the DDI community, is we would like DataCite to include as one of their elements a rich metadata field that would have perhaps two fields, one identifying which metadata standard is being used, and a second field pointing to the metadata that goes with the data. And we hope they're going to discover that, and that might actually be something that might work well with the CNRI approach as well.
Next.
My name's John Gardiner. I'm retired from the National Center for Health Statistics. My question is primarily for Susie, but also for everybody else. You mentioned study design specifically and interface with the R language for statistics. My question is, to what extent do metadata for various databases indicate whether or not there was a specific statistical sample design associated with the data set before it was collected? And secondly, is there a point of contact whereby a statistician could get in touch with somebody who knew the statistical aspects of the data's design, because they'd have to know that in order to do a proper statistical analysis?
I'm going to take this one piece at a time. For the second part, I'm going to say that, well, I'll start with our tool with R is that it's for people who are doing a statistical analysis, and it's to help them go out and find the raw data that they want to use in their analysis, usually across integration across multiple data sets. So that's where it's at now. In terms of what you were talking about, that's part of a design that we have thought about and haven't gotten there yet. And in terms of looking at whether there would be a contact person, at the moment, I would say that most data sets are not well described. In terms of, they barely tell us that what we need to know about the collection of the data set. But one of the areas that I didn't get to talk about in the time we have here is a lot of attention is being paid to workflows, and we're looking at how to identify workflows and how to put workflows either attached to data sets or in a separate location for people to look at it. And the workflows would identify the statistical model that's being used, how it's being done, who it's doing it, and the contact information of that kind. But that would be separate from the data set itself.
I'll say for the our current vision of the NIH data catalog, the answer to that is yes, but it would be as an optional field. We have other optional fields that we're thinking about that would allow people to further define things related to the methods, including the statistics. We're also thinking about ways to make algorithms and software in versions of particular software tools that have been used to analyze the data in a particular scientific publication to make that information available through what we're calling a software catalog. So it's a parallel effort.
So I think what your question points to is the importance of curation. The data has to be curated, so these things are reported in the metadata. For a presentation I'm giving tomorrow, I have some slides showing the sampling and weighting procedures in one of the national surveys of family growth, and it takes me three slides to get through the description of the weighting. And you need all of that information. If that information isn't there, the data really isn't valuable and is likely to be used improperly.
I'm going to add one more piece to that. Several of the information schools, Tennessee being one, Illinois, many others, are working on workforce development in this area, looking at the fact that a trained informationalist, a person who's trained in information sciences, can help in some of these roles of naming and making sure the metadata exists for the data set, so the scientist, the social scientist, the health researcher can do their work and not be bogged down with some of those details.
Let's switch sides a little bit. We're going to take Keith, and then we'll take...
Thanks, Fran. I'm Keith Clark. I'm from UC Santa Barbara and a member of BIRDE. I would argue that the fastest way to find anything is by its geographic location. And Susie, you were the only person here today who even mentioned a geographic search. So I have two things I'd like the panel to just ponder for a minute. And the first is that some of these data, especially the human subjects data, we have good reason to remove geographic location. And yet that is not allowing all sorts of scientists to do all sorts of analysis in my discipline. What do we have to respond to that? The second one is occasionally we have a distributed network of databases now. You could argue that no byte actually has a location anymore. So how do you find data in a spaceless world?
Well, let me respond from... First, most of the data that we have is not geospatially located for confidentiality reasons. So many of the data sets we have, the most geography you get in the United States is a census region, which is about 8 states. We do, however, have a project that we're working on with the Association of American Geographers, where we're using a new technology that we have, which we call a virtual data enclave, which is a remote access, a remote analysis system, as a way to provide a space in which people can use geographically identified information in a safe space, and then that where the outputs can then be subjected to a review, so that the researchers can get the geospatially identified data to work with, but the outputs can be de-identified, and that's one of the solutions that we think needs to happen.
I think this is an important point. We struggle with this a great deal. I think we do have some data in NDAR that is of the type distance from a major highway, distance from a this or that, trying to tease out environmental exposures. That's obviously not as good as the 9-digit zip code or something, which is really what you might want.
And I would say that certainly for our human subject data, that is an issue, but NIH supports a lot of research that would generate data that really isn't relevant to geospatial data. For example, electrophysiological studies of neurons in a rat brain, doesn't really have a big geospatial aspect to it. And we support a lot of basic research like that. But it's the question about the distributed data sets and databases, I think that's an important issue. But it seems to me that if there is a way to access the data, there's a way to capture that information somehow. I'm not sure how generalizable that would be, but I think it's probably tractable.
I'll just add, most of our world is GIS located, obviously. However, we do have to be sensitive to endangered species and things of that nature, to where we have to make some of that data invisible.
I think we'll come over here, and then I think if you're standing, we'll take your question, and if you're not standing, I think we're going to run out of time.
Hi, I'm Barbara Ransom from the National Science Foundation, and this has been really quite eye-opening for me because we have many disciplines that we serve at NSF that don't really have adequate data warehouses or any kind of data management facilities, and we're wrestling with this right now, especially with regard to the White House announcement that came out on Friday for open access of data. My question to you is that there's such a proliferation of potential solutions. Everybody seems to be having something going on here. And are we just looking at everybody creating their own solutions for every field? Or, I mean, what are we thinking about in terms of consolidation and building off everybody's R&D so that we don't end up just spending tremendous amounts of money generating a lot of chaos and sort of energy and activity, but not really coming up with any kind of workable solution? Or is this just where we are in the process?
I would say that that's a real fundamental issue, and we're starting to talk about it at NIH in ways that we haven't talked about it before. Another related issue is kind of a comprehensive view of standards and metadata and so forth, to some extent. NLM has taken a first step in this direction in terms of NIH supported data repositories. Kevin Reed, who's in the audience at NLM, put together. We've got a website, and I actually have a slide of it. I won't bother pulling it up, though. Of some 45 large data repositories that are NIH supported, that accept data from outside of a particular lab, for example, and that make data available, and we've put together a site that I don't have the URL memorized for right now, but we're starting to think about bringing our forces together, if you will, and at least starting to nudge this question forward.
But I do think I want to add on to that. You know, one of the important areas that we just haven't answered as a community, under what circumstances is a field or a data collection format or something ready for aggregation, and at what point do we turn it off? And what are the rules for, you know, it would be, if somehow I had a checklist that said, yes, 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 okay, I know that fMRI is now ready for data aggregation, here's $3 million, go and do it, that'd be great. As long as, you know, but we don't have anything like that, and we also don't have any good way at the moment, as far as I know, to really have metrics on whether data collections are valuable and should be kept around.
I think that's it's a really fundamental question. It does seem that there is an inherent biodiversity to solutions, that there's usually neither one solution nor is there, you know, an infinite set of solutions, and how things cluster. I think it's really interesting to hear the panelists and think and hear about how things are clustering in different communities and trying to predict what perhaps the optimal number of clusters of solutions are. Mike?
Mike Nelson with Bloomberg Government. In my spare time, I teach in a program on communication, culture, and technology. So I have a cultural question, primarily for Greg Farber, but anybody else can answer it too. Your description of what you're doing with NDAR was quite impressive, and only in the number of terabytes you have, you've clearly made some good progress. Is there some reason that the autism data is so interesting and that it attracted so much attention? Is there some reason your community has been able to move faster than others? And any helpful hints there?
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, I guess the bottom line is sometimes it's really good to be the funding agency. We've put terms and conditions on all awards related to autism that have human subjects data that require the data to be deposited in NDAR.
I imagine there are other areas within NIH that aren't quite as far along as you are with autism. Is there some reason that that has been the test case or that that got the attention?
I think the driving force there has actually been the autism community, and it's probably more the families than it is the research community. But I think there's real agreement that this is an area that we just don't know nearly enough about, and data aggregation was felt to be one way that we might get some traction.
A lot of potential factivists out there, yeah.
Bill.
Yeah, hi, Phil Bourne, UC San Diego. I'm a member of Birdie. I guess it's getting near the end of the day, and I'll probably open a can of worms here, but this question relates to, you've all described amazingly elegant ways of finding data. The question is, when I found it, do I really want it? And, this whole issue of distinguishing what I've actually found, which then, of course, opens the question, should I have crowdsourcing curation? Should I have a Yelp-like mechanism that ranks what I'm actually finding? These are questions I'm just wondering whether in your respective areas you're broaching and if you're going to do anything about using this kind of crowdsourcing mechanism.
We have actually explored that idea because it is important. It might help in especially when you're doing data intensive science in the biological sciences. So, for example, for climate change, a lot of times you're bringing together data sets in areas that you might not be as knowledgeable about to see how something that you're interested in interacting is. And so, having a crowdsourcing type approach to knowing what are the best data sets is something that we think would be really valuable. We haven't solved that problem yet, but we're working on it.
I would say that comment kind of closes the loop on something that Greg brought up and putting it a different way. What data are worth saving and sharing? I mean, certainly not everything collected in every laboratory is worth, showing to the world. And this is kind of the other side of that, I guess. And it's something that I think funders have to think about more carefully. I see the promise of today as being at least funders are now starting to think about this at all. And I think that's a big plus, but it's a good question and one I think we'll be considering further as we go forward.
And I do think this is a can of worms. We've started to think about this, and honestly, we're kind of scared about the idea of allowing others to comment, allowing person A to comment about person B's data in a federal data repository. That just doesn't sound like it's going to be something we want to do. We suspect that those battles are going to end up being fought in the literature, and that's okay.
Last question. Oh, sorry, George.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about this and looked at some of our data about what we distribute, and I really don't think that crowdsourcing for the kinds of objects that we distribute makes any sense. Most of our data sets don't get downloaded very, very often. But I think that the issue that Michael raised about how do you decide what to curate, because curation is expensive, is a really important one. And we're working on ideas now about how can we sort of host things while we're trying to figure out what we want to curate. And I think one of the solutions to this is the kind of linking of data to publications that the Data Citation Index does. We've been doing that for about 10 years now. And when I look at that data, it does become clear that you can tell which data sets are going to be important after about 3 years. There's an increase both in publications from the original data, authors and the citations to those publications and in the downloads that I think in a 3 to 5 year time frame, you could actually tell which ones are the good ones to bet on. I'm sure there are other things, and we're happy to have a graduate student at the Michigan School of Information who's going to be working on our records to help us at least think about this problem.
Last question.
I'm Turkan Gardner from Pragmatica Corporation. I found the interactive features of the pie charts relative to autism search of the databases, particularly those where a researcher can explore to see how many cases of this type of characteristics, et cetera, are available. And also your discussion about the confidentiality and the encryption features related to each individual. I want to take the query one step further relative to the new data that are being generated on genomic identifiers. Is there any possibility that these individuals can be put into a longitudinal study adding genomic data or asking them to donate samples of their DNA for explorations of phenotype-genotype relationships?
Yeah, it turns out that many of the subjects that are involved in those studies have donated blood. It's also true that a fair number of the studies really are focused on omics of some sort, either microarray types of GWAS studies, or now we're moving into exome and genome sequencing. And all of that data is available at ENDAR.
Oh, they are.
Yeah, they are available at ENDAR. Now, an important point to remember is that a random individual can't go and get that data. You know, they have to submit, or someone has to submit a request. It has to be to conduct research. It has to go through our data access committee. So we think we're still protecting patient confidentiality or subject confidentiality, even if we're providing full genome sequences, because of the way the data are going to be used.
Thank you.
So I want to thank everyone, and on behalf of both Cliff and I, I'd like to thank all of the panelists. If you think about the significance of this topic, and you think about the impact that the ability to search has really given us in the 21st century, and how it's literally revolutionized what we do in all aspects of our life, I think the examples here and the things that we are trying to do will take us from the 20th century, where we are in the data world, to the 21st century, and imagine the kinds of transformations that can come. So I'd like to thank everyone and wish everyone a good evening.
Thank you.